The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Healthcare Pay, Abysmal. While pundits opine on how to curtail the country's healthcare costs, there's a trend emerging in the Triangle, North Carolina, and across the U.S. Many of the industry's workers are making less than living wage. And the cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Your Health, Their Hands. These jobs are in demand, but hours are hard and pay lags. This is written by Seth Thomas Gulledge. For registered nurse Sandy Wagaman, the difficult days can come just as often as the good. Asked to imagine a shift where she might feel especially fatigued, she quips, that would be yesterday. But that's a common result for nurses running 12-hour shifts that can be mentally and physically draining. Even on your good days, you can still have that bad moment where you have tried and tried and tried and you still lose that patient, Wagaman says, her voice steadily becoming more strained. Or you have to go in with a physician when he tells a family or a patient that it's time to transition to palliative care, that there really isn't anything more the medical profession can offer you. There are times when you have that sweet little grandma who has been doing absolutely phenomenal, but then falls in the nursing home and you have to be with the family when they're dying. There's definitely those days where you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I made it through this day. And the need for those who can make it through such days is on the rise in North Carolina. In fact, nursing is the most common job for healthcare workers in the state, and according to state labor estimates, it will have the most vacancies needing to be filled in the first half of the decade. The high cost of healthcare is capturing public attention as prices rise and jobs in the sector swell. But a Triangle Business Journal analysis found the runaway cost of healthcare is not translating to new high-paying jobs in the state. While registered nurses earn an average salary in North Carolina of $62,940, that figure is actually high compared to the other fastest-growing jobs, where salaries can drop to less than half that. Driving that change is a combination of aging demographics and a fundamental transition in the way healthcare is delivered, one increasingly calling on nurses in even positions that don't require advanced degrees. That recipe is creating a scenario where the fastest-growing sectors of North Carolina healthcare are also those non-degree positions with the worst pay, the longest hours, and, as one researcher politely puts it, the dirtiest work. The reality means the emphasis on home care and holistic solutions is largely resting on the backs of underpaid, low-education positions. While some see these positions as potential paths to better-paying jobs through continued education, others fear they are financial quagmires for vulnerable workers with few other options. And that raises the question of how North Carolina, with its aging population and its ambitious healthcare system, can find thousands of quality workers for jobs paying as little as $20,000 per year. How do you expect to get quality care for that? Asks Aaron Freyer, the UNC Chapel Hill Director of the Program on Research and Policy at the Cecil G. Shepp Center. It's deeply troubling, she says. Big demand, but low pay. The healthcare industry has long been one of the fastest growing sectors of North Carolina's economy. According to research by UNC's Shepp Center, total healthcare employment in the state has grown 73% since 2000, compared to a just 14% baseline growth of total state employment. Healthcare workers now account for close to 10% of the state's total employment. As of 2018, more than 412,800 workers serviced the state's growing population of patients. While these figures may conjure images of white-coated physicians and high-paid surgeons, the majority of the growth involves less glamorous, scrub-clad armies. In fact, 2 out of every 3 healthcare jobs in the state are in nursing or allied health positions. And according to labor estimates by the North Carolina Department of Commerce, the largest growth of healthcare jobs by total volume in the next 6 years will be registered nurses, RNs, such as Wagaman. Topping the rankings just behind RNs are home health aides, nursing assistants, medical assistants, and pharmacy technicians. The highest average salary of any of those jobs, $32,710 for medical assistance. The lowest on the scale are home health aides. They are tasked with caring for the elderly and disabled at home, but earn an average of just $20,390 per year, despite the demand growing by 3.4% year over year. That rate is twice that of RNs and much more than the rate of physicians and surgeons. Like many industries, the compensation for healthcare positions is largely determined by educational level, though the variance is even in even entry-level jobs can still be huge and seemingly determined by other factors. But for educators such as Wake Technical Community College President Scott Rails, the positions are prime sources of students for whom more education could make a profound difference. There are a lot more jobs in those areas, and those are also jobs that can be difficult to support yourself or your family on, he says. So we look at how you create pathways, bridge jobs, and start thinking about these jobs as getting a foothold in the workplace. A lot of those areas are things you can come through Wake Tech and do through a short-term training program that leads to a certification. Then we spend time talking about how to get word to those folks to make sure they know they can build into that degree. With a high school diploma, a home health aid averages $20,000 per year, according to the state. Add a certification for a medical assistant job, and that grows to about $32,000. An associate's degree job, such as a clinical laboratory technician, will bring in about $50,000. And a bachelor's degree wielding RNs, such as Wegerman, average $62,000, and higher than that with experience such as hers. But it is not just abysmal compensation and growing expectations that pose a challenge to filling the thousands of needed jobs. It is the jobs themselves. Janet Dill, a UNC Chapel Hill graduate and professor of sociology at the University of Minnesota, who studies healthcare workers without college degrees, says these are really hard jobs, what we would call dirty work. It's not glamorous. It's bathing people, feeding them, changing diapers, she says. Hard work, and it's compensated at a very low level. Despite those conditions, she says, the low threshold of education and training required provides a supply of workers. The jobs are also performed almost exclusively by women, about 95% of home health aides and nursing assistants, according to Dill. Women historically have cared for children and the elderly and people that need care, and they've done it in unpaid positions in the home, she says. Now we've moved it into the private sector, but there's still a lot of devaluation in terms of women's work. The cause. The faster growth of these jobs is a direct result of the central economic trends and changing policies shaping the healthcare industry, namely, its shifting focus to reducing costs and its response to a rapidly aging population. Freyer and her colleagues at UNC have become especially interested in how changing health strategy has shifted to relying on nurses and lower education workers. This is the result of care shifting outpatient, she says. You have a situation where the payment models are changing, so hospitals and healthcare systems are looking for ways to lower costs, and it's much cheaper to deliver care outpatient. Those changing payment models include the transition to value-based care from fee-for-service, which reimburses providers based on outcomes instead of individual services and forces health systems to share in the total cost. Few places have seen more aggressive push toward the model than North Carolina, which has incorporated the approach into its looming privatization of Medicaid plans and has seen its largest insurer, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, announce value-based care contracts alongside the state's largest health systems last year. Health policy experts and providers say that because the plans call on providers to tackle patient health as a whole, rather than a fix-what's-broken approach, a higher standard of care can be achieved at a lower cost. Central to that strategy is keeping patients out of costly hospital settings and addressing social determinants of health right in their homes, tasks laid on the backs of lower-educated health workers such as home health aides. At the same time, the United States is also facing a rapidly aging generation of baby boomers who will increasingly require home care in the coming years, a potential gold mine for companies racing to offer that care, but one that will require an army of labor. Asked if her research suggests pay for these positions will improve, Freyer answers, "Straight answer is no. I wish that their reimbursement could reflect the value that they bring to the patient and the healthcare system," she says. "Do I think that's going to happen? No. The ladder to the middle class." Now, in her 37th year of nursing at UNC, Rex. Wegeman says one of the things she cherishes about her job is the flexibility. Her few, though long, shifts allowed her to raise a family, and the pay was enough to make ends meet. For generations, nursing has stood as a ladder into the middle class and a secure mode of employment for those with a desire to help others. But even though the average pay for RNs in North Carolina is higher than other jobs across the sector, the issue of undercompensation has plagued the profession for nearly as long. Janice Lorauer, another RN of 34 years and clinical manager at the North Carolina Heart and Vascular Hospital, says she also got into nursing based on a long desire to help people, something she refers to as the heart of a nurse. And though now she celebrates that nurses are now considered an important and equal member of the care delivery team, respected for their insights, she remembers at the beginning of her career, it was still at a place where we got up when we saw a physician coming and gave them our seats. Now they're our colleagues. She notes the erosion of that subservient perception has also led to an increase in pay. For the kind of work that nurses do and for what they provide for the patient, for the organization, and for the community, it seems like they would maybe get paid more, she says. Through time, we have gotten better salaries, maybe not what we would like to see, but we definitely have opportunities to make more if that is your desire. The rise in the compensation of nurses has gone hand in hand with both those perceptive increases and the broadening of their medical roles. Now the question looms of whether compensation for both nurses and lower educated roles, such as aides and assistants, will rise as well. If we're going to shift work that has been historically done by a MD onto someone with a high school degree, we have to make sure we are compensating fairly for the kind of skills that are required and the level of work, Dill argues. Doing so is important if the industry expects to entice the talented workforce needed to raise the quality of care. From an industry perspective, nurses definitely feel that we're underpaid for what we do because we are at times saving people's lives, Wegeman says, whereas a computer programmer is probably making 2.5 times what a nurse is. She is right, even in first-year returns, not to mention longer-term salary projections. According to federal data collected by the U.S. Departments of the Treasury and Education, the average student with a 4-year degree in nursing will graduate from UNC Chapel Hill with about $22,000 in debt and report about $58,000 in first-year salary. An average UNC computer science student will graduate with about $14,000 in debt and earn more than $71,000 per year. Degrees for allied health jobs can be even worse. An average associate degree holding a graduate of Wake Technical Community College with a degree in allied health and medical assisting services will average just under $30,000 their first year while being bridled with about $20,000 in debt. And while there is a chance market conditions could lead to a steady improvement in compensation like that seen in nursing, a realistic timeline for improvement could take years of workers toiling in underpaid roles or systemic policy changes by federal programs such as Medicaid and Medicare to reimburse the services at a higher rate. Until then, a majority portion of the fastest growing healthcare jobs in North Carolina might remain the ones few people want to have. It's hard for me to say that I wouldn't recommend someone becoming a nursing assistant or a home health aide, Dill says. It sounds terrible because we want people to provide that care, but in terms of job quality, it's hard to make that recommendation. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Spring, woo, is coming, and here's what to wear. Here at Biz, we're hopelessly behind when it comes to men's fashion, still believing a pair of duck heads and a polo shirt will do just fine. We totally miss fashion trends such as wingtip shoes and windowpane blue blazers and still look aghast at men who wear patterned shirts with striped suits. But maybe it's time to up our game and join the cool kids when the spring clothes go on sale, so we asked around for some help. Colin Wood of the Gentleman's Corner in Pinehurst tells us blue is always in fashion for men, but he's seeing more hints of green as spring approaches. He's also seeing small mini prints in shirts, adding, "It would have been a print your dad might have worn in the 1950s. Wood says the sharpest look now is a fitted blazer with jeans and stylish shoes. If you're wearing a sports coat and a relatively simple shirt and jeans, then it needs to be capped off with a good-looking pair of loafers, he says. And khakis? Forget it. Wood says gray pants are the rage, followed by blue. Claude Pope III, the owner of Raleigh-based Bald Head Blues, says his lines target the age 35 to 55 demographic and are designed for golfers and a vacation look. A big emphasis this spring is weaving spandex into most products, which improves performance and reduces wrinkles. All of our fabrics for 2020 have some spandex, he says. Blue remains the top color, and Pope is seeing plenty of horsebit loafers and even monogrammed silver belt buckles. One of the state's legendary men's stores is H Stadium, which has been in business in Kinston since 1903. Current owner Hyman Stadium says he is seeing a lot of brighter colors in suits, especially cobalt blue. Light gray is also popular among suits, and fancy socks remain popular. When the spring selections arrive in the coming weeks, they'll go straight to the shelves. We put it out as soon as it comes in, Stadium says. People are ready to see some new stuff after the holidays. They are ready for spring, believe me. Hey, college students, be sure to tell the census you're here. The Triangle is packed with colleges and universities, and that's an issue as the 2020 U.S. Census nears. According to the Census Bureau's website, college students should be counted where they live and sleep the most as of April 1. So a junior at NC State University from, say, Atlanta would count toward Raleigh's numbers and not Atlanta's. Of course, tracking down college students and getting them to respond is easier said than done, and that's part of the reason the Census Bureau is hiring hundreds of thousands of part-time workers to track the numbers. In Wake County, pay averages from $17 to $19 an hour. New event space to break ground soon in South Raleigh. The Triangle is not loaded with places to hold events, as anyone who has looked for options will soon discover, and now a new location is in the works for South Raleigh. Chelsea Hand, who moved to Raleigh with her husband Jeff from outside New York City 3 years ago, plans to open the Maxwell off Gideon Creek Drive in South Raleigh. The venue will seat up to 300 people. When we moved down here, we identified a need for larger event spaces, Chelsea Hand says. Proximity to downtown really was our driving factor. As a bride, if you have people coming from out of town and you're from the Raleigh area, you probably want them staying in downtown Raleigh. Duke graduate cashes in with sale of company. A company co-founded by a Duke University alum was just sold for $5.3 billion. Yes, that's a billion with a B. Visa is acquiring San Francisco-based fintech Plaid, co-founded by Duke graduate Zach Parrott. According to Parrott's LinkedIn profile, he served as a research fellow with the Duke Department of Physics from 2006 to 2010 and was on the Duke Board of Trustees from 2008 to 2010. That's after getting his bachelor's degree after the school. He co-founded Plaid with William Hockey in 2013. Plaid, which intends to operate as an independent business unit under Visa, connects customers' bank accounts to a variety of other fintechs with technology aiming to eliminate the cumbersome process of putting micro deposits into a checking account for verification purposes. Clemson's role in football means big numbers for school. Clemson University may have lost in the National Football Championship to LSU, but the school is continuing to cash in on its football success on and off the field. In 2008, Clemson had 15,542 students apply for the freshman class. In 2018, that number jumped to 28,844. Final numbers for this year aren't in yet, but an admissions counselor tells Biz, "We're running about even." And a CBS News analysis of the Clemson football revenue shows that television dollars, donations, and ticket sales have swelled to $63 million, more than double the number when Dabo Swinney became head coach in 2008. And finally, new ECU program gets recognized again. An effort to prepare students in Eastern North Carolina to become entrepreneurs is receiving more national praise in its inaugural year. The U.S. Association for Small Business and Entrepreneurship awarded East Carolina University's Student Entrepreneurship Program, RISE 29, with its Excellence in Co-Curricular Innovation Award. The ECU program has also ranked as the country's number one entrepreneurship program by U.S. News and World Report. When we first had the idea for the program, we knew we wanted RISE 29 to become a national model for rural entrepreneurship, says Mike Harris, director of ECU's Miller School of Entrepreneurship. We're excited that other entrepreneurship educators from across the country saw the same potential in the program that we did. The program began in February. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Technology and Startups page, written by Lauren Onasorge. How North Carolina beat Texas to reel in Microsoft jobs. The work to land Microsoft's second expansion in North Carolina in 2019 was fast-paced, according to public records released by the North Carolina Department of Commerce. Many of the economic development officials working on Project Kirk had also worked to secure more than 400 Microsoft jobs in Charlotte in October. They worked quickly to finalize plans in November with just days to spare. Microsoft would pledge to bring 500 jobs to Morrisville, a particularly big win in light of the competition. Microsoft is hoping to fast-track the potential approvals, Sydney August from CBRE wrote to economic development officials November 20 regarding an incentives package. Is it possible to call a special EIC meeting if needed? By November 21, however, officials were confident they'd secured the deal, with Commerce Communications personnel starting to formulate a plan for a December announcement. The final application came via FedEx November 25. Microsoft had narrowed down its options to Morrisville and Houston. Texas had offered the company nearly $1.3 million to locate in Houston, records show. North Carolina offered up nearly $13 million, including a $12.1 million job development investment grant, which proved essential in closing the deal, according to what the company repeatedly told state officials. And it would be a big win for both North Carolina and the region, where documents show Microsoft has been working with Trinity Partners for office space. To meet the terms of its agreement, Microsoft has to hire at least 113 people in 2020 and at least 450 by year end 2023. But Microsoft told the state in its JDIG application that this expansion could be just the beginning. Should the site in Morrisville, North Carolina be chosen for this project, it would be likely to assume further growth could occur, the application states. A final project has yet to be determined. This project will locate elsewhere should the state fail to grant the JDIG award. Raleigh Tech Company wants to save lives by using earbuds. At the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this month, a Raleigh sensor company was hunting for a commercial partner for an earbud technology its founder says could one day save lives. Valencell, which develops biometric sensors and already partners with companies such as LG Electronics and Skosh, just unveiled something it has been trying to figure out for a decade: ear sensors that can measure blood pressure, no cuff required. Co-founder and president Stephen LaBeouf, on the phone from Las Vegas, says it's a big deal, so big that any consumer electronic brand you can think of has come by our booth to challenge us. He's hoping that leads to a partnership with one of those big consumer brands, noting that 60 to 70% of Valencell's leads typically come from CES. LaBeouf envisions earbuds that, with a simple download of an app, can not only tell you your real-time blood pressure, but also help you change behaviors that could help you manage that number. Now that we have that solution, it's ready to go, he says. We're ready to commercialize it. And that means teaming up with a wearable device company to create earbuds. LaBeouf says that by using sensors in a device that's already so popular, it becomes more accessible. Experts expect jobs to continue flowing to Raleigh. Ask the experts and they'll tell you the state of the triangle is good. No recession in sight, at least not this year. That's the crux of the speakers at the Raleigh Chamber Launch 2020 event January 9. Mark Vintner, managing economist and senior economist at Wells Fargo, told the crowd he had more good news than I could possibly fit in 12 minutes. Raleigh is still at the top of nearly every list that has something good to say about the economy, he said. Raleigh recovered all the jobs that were lost in the recession by the end of 2012. In 2020, the Raleigh region will add 22,000 jobs, 18,000 jobs in 2021, he said, much of it coming from technology where job growth has been in excess of 5%. And that talent coming in can be key for recruiting job-creating companies. Chris Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, told the crowd, "Talent is trumping everything," he said. "When we're sitting across the table from the companies that are looking at North Carolina, it is overwhelmingly about talent." Raleigh's Mohu acquired by St. Louis antenna firm. After nearly a decade in business, a triangle antenna company is being acquired, a move that its CEO says creates the number one antenna provider in the country. Raleigh-based Mohu, the company behind the Leaf-branded indoor digital antenna, was just acquired by St. Louis-based Antennas Direct. Financial details were not disclosed, but Mohu's majority owner and CEO, Mark Buff, calls it a great deal. "We have been working on this deal for quite some time," he says. And finally, in a section called She Said It, "At the end of the day, you can have all the best resources and technology, but if you're not listening to what people are telling you and reacting to that and doing something about it, you're never going to make a difference." And that's Carrie Stoltz, market leader for Bank of America, talking about her bank's strategy in the Triangle. And now we turn to Caleb Harshberger's page on real estate. Major upgrades planned for buildings. A Salt Lake City investment firm spent more than $60 million this month on a pair of office parks in Raleigh, and it plans to spend millions more on renovations. Bridge Investment Group closed on the purchase of a combined 330,000 square feet of Class A office space with a total price tag of $62.75 million for Capital Center in West Raleigh and Somerset Corporate Center off Falls of Neuse Road. With healthy cash flow from strong anchor tenants, an opportunity to lease up the remaining vacancy and their high-growth locations, these properties represent the value-add sweet spot where Bridge thrives, says Matthew Beam, senior associate for Bridge Investment Group. "We're eager to deploy our improvement plans at Capital Center and Somerset Corporate Center and look forward to reintroducing the revamped contemporary office product." Both properties were sold by the Dilwig Companies of Durham. Between the two properties, Capital Center had the higher price at $33 million, according to a deed filed January 13th. The property is situated on 6.7 acres at 5511 Capital Center Drive and features 161,698 square feet of Class A office space. The property is 93% occupied with tenants including Plexus Services Corporation, K4 Connect Incorporated, MyComputerCareers.com, and Certara USA Incorporated, according to a release. The complex was built in 1986. Bridge Investment Group plans to invest an additional $2.95 million in the property, including upgrades to corridors and restrooms on each floor and renovations to the outdoor plaza. Microsoft building in Morrisville on the market. Microsoft's home in Morrisville is for sale, featuring 185,000 square feet of office space in Perimeter Park and a long-term lease set to last for a decade. The Microsoft at Perimeter Park office complex at 1009 Think Place has 186,077 square feet across five stories of Class A office space that's fully leased for the next 10 years. The building's only tenant, Microsoft, first leased space in Perimeter Park in 2016. The company now plans to expand to take all rentable space in the building. Microsoft's lease on the building doesn't expire until June 2030. The lease includes annual contractual rent increases of 2.5%. According to marketing materials, the time left on the remaining lease term translates to a total of $44.7 million of net operating income, an average of $4.4 million annually. Perimeter Park is a 21-building office park in Morrisville, totaling 700,000 square feet of Class A office and industrial space near Research Triangle Park. Other tenants include Syneos, Channel Advisor, Teleflex Medical, and many others. The 3-million-square-foot development is located off Highway 54, just south of Interstate 4540 interchange. Trinity Capital, Starwood Capital Group, and Vanderbilt Partners bought the park in 2015 as part of a larger $1.1 billion portfolio purchase from Duke Realty. County records show the investors paid $38 million for the property, now known as Microsoft, at Perimeter Park. Home building giant proposes 180-plus townhomes in Cary. More townhomes are in the works for Cary. National home builder Lennar Corporation is adding to its list of projects in the Triangle, with more than 180 homes proposed for the northwest part of town. Plans have been filed with the town for a development called James Grove at Alston Town Center, a 184-townhome community near Parkside Town Commons and Alston Town Center. The project is on 45 acres, situated at 2020 Alston Avenue, and is made up of five different parcels owned by a collection of families and individuals in Cary. Currently, the land is mostly vacant, with a few parcels holding single-family homes. Plans call for 73 townhomes to be built in the first phase and 111 in the second phase. Both phases will have front and rear loaded units. No timeline or pricing was available. Knightdale Industrial Park reaches capacity. The sign reads "No vacancy" at a Triangle Industrial Park now that the new tenant has scooped up the remaining space. Trans-Pacific Suppliers Alliance is leasing 120,000 square feet of space in the Hinton Oaks Industrial Park outside of Knightdale. The park is owned by Wake Stone Corporation and totals more than 500,000 square feet. Wake Stone announced the new lease January 13. The new tenant will fill a 120,000 square foot building representing the last of the available space in the 524,000 square foot industrial park. The final building is set to deliver in April and was pre-leased by another entity. It's the last of four spec buildings Wake Stone has built over 7 years. Hinton Oaks Industrial Park is situated on 48 acres at 550 Hinton Oaks Boulevard west of downtown Knightdale. Wake Stone development manager Colin Perry says while the project did come with risk, the company believed there was enough demand to fill it. Given the growth of the region, we felt confident in the long-term viability of Hinton Oaks as an industrial park, Perry says. South Carolina developer eyes Briar Creek for latest apartment project. Woodfield Development, a South Carolina luxury developer behind many Triangle projects, has asked the city of Raleigh to rezone a 14-acre property in Briar Creek to allow for a 261-unit apartment community. The vacant property is situated at 3900 McCaw Street by Briar Creek Commons and the Interstate 540 and Highway 70 interchange. Plans for the community call for five new buildings up to four stories. The new apartments will feature 116 one-bedroom, 120 two-bedroom, and 25 three-bedroom units, and apartments will range in size from 672 to 1,673 square feet. Rental rates are expected to fall between $1,000 and $2,500. And finally, in a section called The Big Number, 319.82, the number of square feet for the project, which will feature five new buildings. On healthcare and education is Seth Thomas Gulledge's page. The first headline, Prepping for More Growth, Trial Card Plans for Acquisitions in 2020. After locking down back-to-back years of growth, TrialCard CEO Mark Bauck says his company is gearing up for a strong 2020 that could come with more acquisitions. 2019 was the best financial year in the company's history, he says. The year included four acquisitions, and the company reported 42% organic revenue growth. Bauck says the Morrisville-based company is anticipating strong growth in 2020. I don't know if it will be the 40% range, but definitely we're still looking at 20-plus percent or in that ballpark, he says. TrialCard has been working for years to create an end-to-end patient platform to guide customers through the hurdles of the healthcare process. In 2018, the company reported 44% growth. Our vision and our mission has been to do everything we can to better that engagement with the patient. Everything we're doing is to help that patient along that medication journey, Bauck says. Obviously, that's a need that's never going away and is only becoming greater and greater with specialty medications. In 2019, TrialCard announced the acquisition of Policy Reporter, San Francisco-based Mango Health, Raleigh-based RX Solutions, and TC Script, a dispensing pharmacy in Arizona. He says more buys are already in the pipeline. We're still going to be very inquisitive, Bauck says. We are right now targeting a couple big potential acquisitions, so we're still going to be very inquisitive out there in the marketplace. He says the activity would absolutely be in 2020. The company is looking for partners with great technology to improve its patient software, he adds. TrialCard is also looking across borders for future expansion, specifically taking an interest in Canadian expansion this year. In the future, Bauck says it is considering Europe for potential expansion of its clinical trials work. The company currently employs about 1,600, up from 1,300 in early 2019, across 11 locations. About 1,300 are based in the Triangle. PPD plans to go public again. A North Carolina contract research organization is heading back to the public markets in a soon-to-come initial public offering, according to paperwork filed with regulators. Pharmaceutical Product Development of Wilmington filed its S-1 with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission on January 9. In November, PPD announced its interest to go public again. The preliminary statement does not disclose how many shares or the expected price per share. Company officials declined to comment on the offering, saying applicable securities laws restrict further comment at this time. The company plans to trade under the ticker symbol PPD on the NASDAQ Global Select Market. According to its filing, the company plans to use the proceeds from the offering, along with existing cash, to pay off a pair of high-interest rate holdco loans totaling $550 million and $900 million, respectively. The initial notes mature on May 15, 2022, and have an interest rate of 7.6% or 8.3%. The company, founded in the mid-1980s by Fred Eshelman, first went public in 1996, trading on the NASDAQ. In late 2011, it was acquired by a pair of private equity firms for $3.9 billion. In 2017, PPD's owners, Hellman and Friedman, and the Carlyle Group agreed to recapitalize PPD and bring in new investors. The Abu Dhabi Investment Authority and Singapore's Sovereign Wealth Fund, GI, in a transaction that valued the company at around $9 billion. PPD reported $3.7 billion in revenue in 2018 and more than $2.9 billion in the 9 months ended September 30, 2019. As of that date, it holds $403.9 million in cash and cash equivalents. Clinical development services represented 81.2% of its revenue during the period, with the remainder generated from its laboratory services segment. Heat Biologics prepares for public offering. A Triangle drug maker is kicking off 2020 with a planned public stock offering of its own. Heat Biologics has filed a registration statement with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission in preparation for a public offering of its stock. According to the filing, the proposed maximum of the round is $14.2 million. The company estimates net proceeds of the offering will be approximately $6.9 million or $8 million if underwriters exercise their options. The company plans to offer 17 million shares of its common stock together with a number of common warrants to purchase 8.5 million shares. UNC looks into the danger of vaccine misinformation. A UNC Chapel Hill study into the results of misinformation surrounding vaccines in Denmark has revealed the difficulty of countering that narrative and the damage it can do. UNC researchers analyzed the results of broad misinformation regarding HPV vaccines for women in Denmark from 2013 to 2016, suggesting the vaccines were dangerous. In 2017, the nation launched a public campaign to fight back, but according to research led by Peter Hansen, a UNC Chapel Hill professor of economics from Denmark, the damage from the misinformation has had a real impact. The research found that during the peak of the misinformation, vaccination rates for HPV dropped by more than 50%. The vaccine is recommended for girls age 11 or 12 because it is most effective during the time period and because infections often begin at 13. Triangle MedTech firm brings in $22 million. Contigo Medical of Raleigh has filed notice with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission regarding a $22.3 million raise, and sales of the equity offering began December 27. Contigo develops a range of medical devices for unmet needs in the cardiovascular and peripheral vascular space. The company is centered on the intellectual property of Dr. Ravish Sarkar, its founder, chairman, and CEO. Sarkar is also the physician-in-chief of the North Carolina Heart and Vascular Hospital at UNC Rex. The filing said 10 investors participated in the funding, led by Hatteras Venture Partners of Durham. And now we turn to the On Business page in the Triangle Business Journal, written by David Pertell. Hillbilly Elegy author launches fund for startups. Investor J.D. Vance, author of the best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, has launched a venture capital firm that will focus on startups in multiple cities, including Raleigh and Durham. Vance has raised $93 million towards a targeted $125 million fund to launch Ohio-based Naria Capital. The firm will also invest in startups in other underserved cities such as Salt Lake City and Atlanta, Axios reports. It has fund backing from major names including Peter Thiel, Mark Andreessen, Eric Schmidt, and Scott Dorsey. The Cincinnati-based firm is co-founded by Vance and VC veteran Colin Greenspan. He and Vance had worked together before at Thiel's Mithril Capital, according to Triangle Business Journal's sister publication, Cincinnati Business Courier. Vance, an Ohio native, had split his time between Columbus, Ohio and Washington, D.C. as managing partner with Steve Case's Rise of the Rest VC fund. He left the fund and moved to Cincinnati last year. Like Rise, Naria will focus on technology companies in markets overlooked by most VCs, Axios reported. Its growth stage investments will be in the $5 million to $10 million range. We invest long-term capital in people who use technology to solve significant challenges, Naria's website says. Vance wrote his best-selling 2016 memoir about his Appalachian upbringing in Middletown, Ohio, and the socioeconomic and cultural issues he and his family faced. A film version is set to be released on Netflix. Vance, an Iraq War veteran who studied political science and philosophy at Ohio State University and law at Yale University, is an executive producer on the film. Naria joins another VC fund that was recently started to focus on Triangle startups. Last year, StrikeIron founder Richard Holcomb launched the North Carolina Venture Capital Fund to invest in new tech firms in the region. North Carolina population nearing 10.5 million. The latest U.S. Census data estimates the Tar Heel State added 106,000 people between July 2018 and July 2019, the fourth most in the country behind Arizona, Florida, and Texas. North Carolina's population is approaching 10.5 million. It's the ninth largest state behind Georgia and ahead of Michigan, and North Carolina's population grew by 1% from 2018 to 2019, the 10th fastest rate in the nation. The state added nearly 1 million people during the last decade. South Carolina was also among the fastest growing states between 2018 and 2019, but its total population remains half the size of North Carolina. California remains the most populous state by far, with 37 million people, but the Golden State did see a slight drop in population from 2018 to 2019. Texas is second with 25 million. The 2020 census is also fast approaching, and it could lead to North Carolina gaining its 14th congressional seat. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to a better world inside the Triangle's nonprofit scene. First, we start with a column written by Lori O'Keefe, who is the president and CEO of Triangle Community Foundation. The headline, Accurate Count Crucial for North Carolina as Census Approaches. The 2020 census is vital to the health of our community. An accurate census count will have major implications for our state over the next 10 years, from fair congressional representation to informing how much money our local and state governments will have to spend on education, housing, disaster recovery, and infrastructure programs. Data from the census is also used by governments, business, and nonprofits to determine community needs and make decisions on where to allocate funding for the future. This fall, Triangle Community Foundation held a Community Impact Series event regarding the census. Rebecca Tippett, Director of Carolina Demography, and Stacy Carlos, Executive Director of NC Counts Coalition, joined donors and nonprofit leaders to describe the impact and importance of the census and the challenges they see in achieving an accurate count and their Get Out the Count strategy to engage and educate communities across the state about the census. What we learned is that an undercount could mean a misalignment between our community's needs and the allocation of federal resources. Data obtained from the census will inform decision makers in all sectors and lead to allocation of political power and financial resources. If the data is inaccurate, there will be inequitable distribution of resources for basic community needs, including but not limited to education, food and income security, health care, housing, transportation, and more. North Carolina receives about $16 billion annually in federal funding from census-guided federal programs, and a single missed person is almost equivalent to a forfeited $16,000 in funding for North Carolina over a 10-year period, according to Counting for Dollars. The Triangle is populous, diverse, and constantly changing. We are home to many communities of color, students, renters, non-family shared households, children, and immigrant residents. This also means that our population can be especially hard to count. There are many challenges that can contribute to an inaccurate census, including lack of internet access. The internet will be the primary form of data collection for the census, especially in rural communities. Confidentiality concerns, distrust of the government, misunderstandings over who needs to be counted, a lack of stability in housing, language barriers, and more. When people experiencing these hardships are not counted or miscounted, they risk losing funding and resources and representation in our government. We want our community members to thrive, and we know that fair representation is one of the primary ways we can ensure that our nonprofits, as well as our local and state governments, are allocated the necessary monies to meet the changing needs of our region. The strong nonprofit organizations in our region are grounded in communities and interact daily with many of the hard-to-count populations. They are trusted messengers and need support so that they can incorporate census outreach into their activities, in addition to the vital work they do for our residents each and every day. It's up to all of us to work together so that we can ensure that everyone in the Triangle can thrive. Let's get out the count. And in nonprofit news, groups find ways to help homeless move to housing. Wake County residents looking to move from homeless to stable housing are getting help from several efforts looking to provide a lift. Band Together is teaming up with the Merriman Wynn House in downtown Raleigh to host a fundraiser on March 6th for Families Together of Wake County. The event, called An Evening to Ignite, is looking to raise more than $100,000, which helps provide short-term and long-term housing options for families facing homelessness. Families Together is Band Together's nonprofit partner for 2020. Band Together uses music to raise money for various charities. Band Together has not yet announced its headline act for its 2020 concert. Helping families move from homelessness to stable housing also has been the focus of the Realtor Foundation of Wake County, the nonprofit arm of the Raleigh Regional Association of Realtors, with a membership of over 8,500. The foundation has been partnering with local housing nonprofits to fill in gaps in services for families in need, including the Green Chair Project, Families Together, Family Promise, and CASA. This past holiday season, a total of 43 families were in fully furnished apartments thanks to efforts over the past 3 years. The Realtor Group also delivered 24 air conditioning units to senior citizens and gave out grants to CASA, the Hope Center at Pullen, and Dorcas. Habitat gets big check. Habitat for Humanity of Wake County has partnered with Town Bank to help with the mortgages of 17 families who have purchased homes through Habitat Wake's home ownership program. The investment is a total of $1.9 million. The mortgages enable these families to build and purchase homes of their own, which leads to stronger and more resilient neighborhoods, said Ann Connor, president of the Public Finance and Community Investment at Town Bank. It also provides Habitat with the liquidity necessary to build even more homes so no one is left behind as Wake County continues to see tremendous growth. Food for college students. Interfaith Food Shuttle, a local food charity based in Raleigh, is looking to provide food for college students in need. The nonprofit opened a food pantry at a local community college in 2015, and after seeing this need grow, they established food pantries at two more community colleges in 2017 and 2019. A $31,200 grant from Arby's Foundation will expand the pantry project further by increasing Interfaith Food Shuttle's refrigeration capacity to offer more fresh fruit and veggies from their urban gardens. Speaker addresses mourning. An expert on jewelry used in mourning will speak at Oakwood Cemetery on January 19th at 2 p.m. Lord Hayden Peters of Australia has studied how people use jewelry to express mourning through the centuries, and his talk will focus on the 18th and 19th centuries. Peters will speak for an hour and then take questions. And finally, Fund appoints a new leader. Kevin Dick has been named the new president and CEO of Carolina Small Business Development Fund, a statewide community lender based in Raleigh. He was recently the deputy director of economic development for the city of Charlotte for 4 years, where he championed equitable workforce development and small business growth. We are extremely pleased that Kevin will be part of the CSBDF family, Board Chair Tony Hayes said. We feel that he is the right person at the right time for the organization and are looking forward to his strong leadership. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Why Home Reappraisals Went Through the Roof in Wake County. It did not take long. We started getting phone calls and emails as soon as the first batch of notifications went out from Wake County detailing the changes in the taxable value of homes. Exactly how did the county decide on the percentage increase of specific lots and buildings? We heard about a home in North Hills that had a 10% depreciation in the building value, but a 30% increase in land value. We also heard about an Inside the Beltline home that fell almost 40% in building value, but doubled in land value. I'm pretty sure many of the 1.1 million people residing in the county had similar questions. The short answer is Wake County is on a tear, and the demand and supply of homes in specific areas has pushed valuations through the roof. So while some may think the housing and economic environment may not have changed that much since 2016, the previous reappraisal period, the numbers show economic activity in the county has, in fact, increased faster than most counties in the state. But it is more complex. It is the more complex answer that requires attention. Previously, Wake County had 8 years to complete the general appraisal of nearly 400,000 properties. That work is now done in 4 years because the county commissioners changed the process in 2016. Whit Putney, the state's deputy tax administrator, says the county went to SAS, the Cary-based business intelligence software giant, to create a redundant system. SAS built cloud-based machine learning models for the county that considered hundreds of factors and daily property sales to offer predictable market forecasts. It was the company's VIA system that independently predicted the market value of all properties on January 1, 2020, based on recent sales data. Putney says the county staff did their own analysis and used the SAS results to compare the findings. We found our numbers on the whole were very close, he says. We also found SAS's numbers were not that accurate on higher price points. Putney added that he was reserved in the use of the SAS data because on an overall basis, SAS's reappraisal numbers were on the higher side. We went the conservative route, he says. The county is expected to generate about $33 million in new revenue from properties, most of which will come from new homes built across Raleigh, Cary, Apex, and other locales. But property owners could receive a much bigger tax bill if the commissioners decide to go the route of going beyond the revenue neutral rate and set up a new tax rate based on the reappraisals. The potential tax hit will not be known until May or June. For homeowners looking to sell, the new wave of reappraisals is good news. Almost everyone agrees the listing price of a home is higher than the county's reappraised value. But in a tight market, when several buyers are bidding above the listing price, mortgage loans become tough to structure unless, of course, buyers are putting down a hefty chunk in cash. Now, you know the price of growth. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a column written by Mark Murrow, who is a senior fellow and policy director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at Brookings. Research analyst Jacob Witten and research associate Robert Maxim assisted with the report. The headline, What Jobs Are AI Poised to Disrupt? Artificial intelligence, AI, remains a riddle for those of us wondering about its potential impacts on workers, but big and often vague claims have been made about AI's potential to do things like improve perception, for example, in medical diagnosis from scans, automate judgment, i.e. hate speech detection, and predict social outcomes for policing or job screenings. Yet for all that, the technology remains a fluid and emergent topic with no single definition and relatively little real-world examples of adoption to learn from. Most notably, it's very hard to parse what work AI may take over from humans when there's no agreement on what exactly it can do. Fortunately, a path-breaking paper by our Stanford University colleague Michael Webb cuts through many of the subjective claims and assessments. Webb's method finds the overlap between common job descriptions and new AI-based patents to detail, in precise, objective terms, what AI can or may soon be capable of in the workplace. From a pool of 16,400 patents, Webb compiled 8,000 verb-object word pairs using a natural language processing algorithm. Since patents are predictions of future commercial relevance, Webb's verb-object pairs come about as close as we can get to understanding how researchers and companies anticipate AI may be deployed. And since applicants must pay non-trivial fees for filing patents, these words' predictive value likely exceeds purely subjective expert assessment. In that sense, these 69 verb-object pairs amount to an unusually well-grounded source of insight about what AI does or may soon do. What do these word pairs say about AI's capabilities? The verbs recognize, detect, and determine suggest a wide variety of AI capabilities focused on augmenting human perception. Pairings such as recognize face, detect abnormality, or identify illegality point to a relatively straightforward set of empirical or measurement activities on which AI has been making genuine rapid progress. On this front, AI now often exceeds human accuracy, whether it be for voice and facial recognition or in transportation, medicine, or consumer protection. Related to this work in perception is a series of control activities, control process, control emission, control traffic, etc. These verb-object pairs seem to point to an array of capabilities in which AI will link enhanced perception to automated command-control activities in order to automatically optimize performance, say, of energy efficiency at a power plant. Some of this perception and control work currently involves human monitoring, but seems relatively routine rather than higher order or deeply human. With that said, some of the verb-object pairs do appear to entail higher-ordered human-centric capabilities. The verbs determine, classify, and predict are especially suggestive. Each of these activities entails a form of categorization of inputs characteristic of human intellect. Pairings such as determine relevance and determine risk, or classify data and classify pattern, all involved abstract conceptual analysis as well as, especially, pattern recognition. For that matter, capabilities such as predict performance, predict behavior, or predict prognosis signal that patented AI applications have already begun to mimic high-level human mental processes. While AI does not yet seem poised for any near-term substitution of all aspects of human cognition, it is pushing toward one particular aspect of intelligence, prediction, which is central to decision-making and an essential aspect of all kinds of occupations. Prediction under conditions of uncertainty, as Ajay Agarwal, Joshua Gans, and Avi Goldfarb observe, is a widespread and challenging aspect of many information sector jobs in health, business, management, marketing, and education. It's no surprise, then, that our recent analysis concluded that high-skill, high-wage occupations would be the most affected by AI. Occupations such as financial managers, programmers, market research specialists, and management analysts, prediction is ubiquitous but especially central as one moves higher up the white-collar occupational ladder. And we'll stop there as we've just about finished the article because we have run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.